KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Festival running through February 8th. Real Music explores the lively interplay between sound and image and music and culture. Friday, January 22nd, Lee Scratch Perry, Visions of Paradise will be showing. Filmed over 15 years, this film has been described as a fairy tale documentary, an almost impossible to believe portrait of the prophet of the International Rastafari movement, one of the icons of the Black Power movement, and arguably the inventor of Jamaican music as we know it. That's January 22nd at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center in the Witzel Auditorium at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information of the films and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The KBOO Community Radio Artist in Residence program assists artists working creatively with sound. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KBOO mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The goals of the KBOO Artist Support Program are to support and invest in individuals who are pushing themselves artistically using sound, whose work will impact the cultural landscape of Portland, and to bring those artists into the dynamic KBOO community of local, national, and international artists and activists. Applications for the 2016 KBOO Artist in Residence are due February 12th at 5 p.m. More information and application materials are at kboo.fm/AIR2016.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. My name is Camille Perry, and this is Talking Earth. Tonight, I'm pleased to bring you guys a show that's a little bit different than usual. My guest this evening is Christopher Corbell. He's a poet, musician, and the composer of the recent Portland opera smash, Viva's Holiday. How are you, Christopher?
I'm great, Camille. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. What can you tell our audience about yourself?
I've been in Portland since 2000, and I lived in on the coast of Oregon for a while before that, so I've been in Oregon long enough to get used to the rain, and also to really thrive on the culture. I feel like there's stuff I'm doing here that I absolutely couldn't do anywhere but Portland, so I'm really glad to be here. And I'm originally from Louisiana. I studied music theory and composition for 2 years out of high school before I got discouraged and depressed and felt like I wasn't of that cast, and I dropped out and was a vagabond poet, songwriter for a number of years and played in bands and that sort of thing. You don't know anything about that, though, do you?
I don't know anything about that, Christopher. So, Christopher, you say that you're doing something a little bit different. What kind of material do you have for us this evening?
So tonight I brought in this project I'm working on this year that's a set of sonnets, original sonnets. Most of them, all of them so far are the English Shakespearean kind of form, although I'm, you know, kind of tempted to go Italian, Petrarchan here and there. And the sonnets are set to music, and it's sort of a mashup for me between the composer stuff that I worked on over the last 5 years preparing to write an opera. I did a lot of art song kind of settings for classical singers and set sonnets and other kinds of poems, and really enjoyed it. But, you know, my background is more just singer-songwriter doing, you know, Americana, doing sort of post-punk, whatever you call that, underground, nihilist, disgruntled, you know, drunken songs. And so this is kind of a combination of those crossing of the streams, because I missed playing. You know, I had this wonderful experience producing this opera, which I don't know if I should say this, but you were also involved. Camille played a key part in as the stage manager for this opera. So
that I did.
So now they know the secret.
Don't tell anyone.
But yeah, so the sonnets project, it's bringing that kind of classical through composed approach, and I really loved setting sonnets because there's just this organic structure to them, mm-hmm. but it's outside of the normal verse chorus thing, and I was ready to move kind of to something new as a songwriter mm-hmm. too, and I missed performing, so I'm getting out and performing these more, and it's really fun.
Fabulous. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about the first sonnet you're going to share, and go ahead and perform one for us.
Great, thanks. And also, you know, I've adopted this. I call it my shtick, my poet, composer, songwriter mashup shtick, where I recite the poems before I play them. You know, and if you go to like a recital for art songs, they'll usually have the text printed out because they're usually in German or Italian or something. So you have to have them. But it also, I mean, it makes you actually kind of notice the text. And I found as a songwriter, a lot of times, the words are the first thing to go. Like, people will know you for a decade and say they love that song, and then you realize 10 years later they still don't actually know what you're saying.
Right.
So I started this thing where with each sonnet I recite it before I play it in performance. And so far I've gotten pretty good feedback. It'll be interesting to see how it works on the radio. So this sonnet's called On Her Walk. It's my newest completed one, and it's inspired by the urban decay poetry or the urban decay photography of our mutual friend Jessica Beer, who really finds these spaces in the urban landscape where there's this abstract kind of beauty emerging in rusted things and in, you know, broken, you know, brick and just strange textures. And this sonnet, I feel like, kind of talks about, it's not just about the photographs themselves. I reference some of the images, but it's also about kind of her eye and how, I think, in the midst of this construction and gentrification going on, like, she really has this eye for the things that are not only maybe defying that a little bit, but also keeping some kind of more organic beauty in the landscape or something. So
absolutely. The photos are beautiful. I can only imagine the pieces as well.
So this is called On Her Walk. Broken pavement leaf prints under sole, iron painted with the blood of rain, ink flows through the poster on the pole, one green shoot twines up the metal drain, green paint on the red brick, chiseled, chipped, chains on textured gates in cold, thick groups, scribbled cracks, unconscious urban script, faces formed in razor wire loops. Any wall can be a prison wall. All her walls are canvases of time where decadence bookends the wrecking ball, defies the crane, the crew, the shiny crime. In between construction sites, they talk, old stones and broken things loved on her walk. Broken pavement leaf prints under sole, iron painted with the blood of rain, ink flows through the poster on the pole, one green shoot twines up the metal drain. On textured gates in cold, thick groups, scribbled cracks, unconscious urban script, faces formed in razor wire loops. Any wall can be a prison wall. All walls are canvases of time where decadence bookends the wrecking ball, defies the crane, the crew, the shiny crime. In between construction sites they talk, loved on her walk.
That was gorgeous. Oh my gosh. I got to hear a couple of Christopher's sonnet songs as the pre-show for Viva's Holiday, which we'll talk more about later, I'm sure. All the burning questions. But that is probably my favorite that I've heard yet.
Oh, it's thanks. Gorgeous. Awesome.
Very nice.
I think it's the hit.
You think it's the hit?
Yeah.
Definitely. The first single, maybe.
Yeah.
So when did you start writing poetry, and how did you find your way to poetry?
I think my first attempts at poetry were probably in high school, maybe middle. I know I definitely read in middle school. I read some E.E. Cummings. I read some other, you know, I read Poe and some Shakespeare and stuff around, you know, that I just found in the library around the house or whatever. And I think my first attempts were around that age. And I definitely started writing songs. So it was kind of around the same period. In fact, I can remember from a very young age, the music and words, creative outlets, both being kind of equally pulling at me. When I was five, I wanted to be either a writer or a musician, and I couldn't decide which. And I feel like I still haven't decided which. So
I don't think any of us really should decide on one. So why sonnets?
So, yeah, interestingly, so I mentioned earlier that I really loved when I set sonnets as sort of classical compositions, that they lent this sort of integrity and this lyrical, you know, thing to the structure of the song. That last song was more of a traditional songwriter structure, which sometimes they work for, but other times it's a much looser thing, and it's a much looser kind of a structure. But something about just the size, the length of it, and where the rhythms and rhymes are, musically really works. But interestingly, like even before I thought about writing art songs, I was writing sonnets actually in college, like when I was, you know, 18, 19, right out of high school. And I had kind of the same experience with an English teacher that I had with my music composition teacher, because I showed her one of my sonnets, and her response is, well, you know, that's nice, but people don't really write sonnets anymore.
I write sonnets.
and it was kind of the same experience, you know, being a young music theory and comp major at the end of the 20th century, feeling like I want to understand what Beethoven did. I want to understand motivic stuff. I want to have a deeper understanding of harmony. And, you know, I had, you know, it's been this groupthink for 50 years that, you know, you don't even put key signatures down when you're a composer anymore, because that's just not how, you know, it's not relevant. I have a comparison. It's kind of like, I'm kind of getting off the topic, but I feel like a lot of 20th century art was kind of like the Esperanto of culture, where, you know, in the Renaissance, like they switched from Latin, which was like the learned language of the elite, to writing, like, you know, Boccaccio and Dante would write in Italian. It's like, write in the people's language, talk to the people. Well, the people's language is still tonality, and, you know, it's still like, approachable music. But, you know, in the early 20th century, Esperanto was this engineered language meant to be kind of a new Latin to take the place of all these disparate languages, so that we'd have a new lingua franca. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, you can't engineer human beings' languages in music or in poetry or in anything else. Like, it's a top-down approach just doesn't work. You have to let it come up from the people. So.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I kind of digress there, but but anyway, I dig sonnets. I think they work, and if they work, like, you know, whatever works for you, you should do, basically. So,
absolutely.
Whatever unlocks the
door. I mean, for those that may not be necessarily as familiar with exactly the sonnet form that you're speaking of, can you kind of break that down a little bit so that they know what we're talking about when we're saying, oh, well, the rhyme scheme and all of those things?
Yeah, and I'm not like a super scholar or anything, but I'm pretty sure Petrarch was the first sonnet writer, an Italian poet who wrote this wonderful cycle of sonnets, love sonnets. And then the next author that we associate, especially in the English language, with sonnets is Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And his form of sonnets was a little bit different, but it was pretty much the same. And so it's 14 lines. And what 14 lines gives you is these little groupings within the 14 lines. And in Shakespeare sonnets, which is mostly what I'm doing, there's sort of four line little stanzas, and then there's a couplet at the end, and that's how the rhyme scheme follows that. In the Italian sonnets, it's a little different. And a lot of, you know, even in English language, a lot of poets will write both you know, both forms. And so you have a rhyme scheme and these stanzas, and usually somewhere around after line 8, usually for the last 6 lines, there's kind of this turn. There's there's some kind of, it's kind of like, I think of it kind of like as a longer haiku almost, like a more argumentative haiku, right? Because haikus are all supposed to have a turn in that third line. It's supposed to kind of like shift you out of the little image that you had and make you think of something else. And there's, you know, a lot of, especially Shakespeare sonnets, they are argumentative, and you get that little twist at the end. And especially I like that last little couplet because it's kind of like the punchline. It's like the last little thing, so.
Absolutely. Well, would you like to share another sonnet with us?
I'd love to. And this one definitely gets outside of the normal singer-songwriter structure a little bit. And this is another fairly recent one. This is called Kundalini. And the topic is... it's about that sort of energy where you really feel something in you that needs to surpass itself, that where you need to change your life, you need to make your life more meaningful, you need to do something. And I guess I kind of have a beef with the 20th century because that's a topic in this one too, where, you know, we see so many articles on Facebook and stuff talking about all these impulses we have and what they are neurologically and what they are chemically. And I think that's a relic of this kind of behaviorist, materialist view of the 20th century that we don't have souls. You know, it's just like, you know, it's all just chemical reactions. But then the question is, like, where did the chemical reactions come from? Was it just accidents that, you know, chemicals combined in the ocean and made life, and life accidentally did all that? And I think subjectively, you know, if our sense of value in life is that your journey means something, there's a disconnect there. There's like a problem with that. And so one of the questions I would ask is, if someone's telling you that you don't have a soul, that it's just these chemical reactions, what's their angle? Like, maybe they have something to gain for telling you that. So, Kundalini. It coils inside me like a solar snake, spring compressed. The spirit's double helix, twisting dreams asleep and thoughts awake in drafts of bitter liquor. Culpa felix, which is the fuel of self-surpassing fire. Nature's angel, how did you emerge? Was it just desire through desire? Survival's reflex, prismed in the urge of time-wise animals trapped in death's world. A brutal century has passed, which taught this seed more accident than God spark hurled into the heart. Empire shifts its thought, quick to call your calling secondary. Keen to mine the ember that you carry.
Of bitter liquor, cup of fear. survival's reflex, prismed in the urge of time-wise animals trapped in death's world. Century has passed, which taught this seed more accident than God's spark hurled into the heart. Empire shifts its quick to call your calling secondary. Came to mind the ember that you
lovely. Oh my goodness. I will have you know that I'm already being contacted, being told how beautifully you play. So the audience seems to be enjoying it as well.
Oh, sweet. Thank you.
So, Christopher, I'm going to ask you about this wonderful experience that we just got to share together. You composed this one-act opera called Viva's Holiday. So you'd been coming from this place of writing sonnets and songs and all of these things. How did you end up writing an opera then?
Well, it doesn't happen by accident.
We both know that.
I was like the Star Trek Enterprise. I was on a 5-year mission. About 2010, actually, I was getting back into composition, and I decided I want to write an opera. And I mean, I didn't really know. I mean, I'd studied music composition. I actually listened to a lot of operas. I did an opera radio show on the coast when I lived out there on Sunday mornings. I did the opera show for KMUN for a little bit, and I was drawn to the form, and I had ideas for an opera, but I started at that point by doing a couple of things. One is I got involved with Classical Revolution PDX, which is a group in town that once a month has this kind of open jam for classical music at the Waypost, and it's awesome. And it was really kind of the perfect thing for me, not being so cut out for the academic route, to be able to go down and hang out with these really, really great chamber musicians and, you know, bring down string parts, bring down different things to try out just to kind of get my game up, you know, with composition. And around the same time, I also took an adult class at Portland Opera. They have this adult summer class where they kind of go through this really cool sequence where they show you behind the scenes, like how operas get made. It's kind of like the how it's made thing for opera. And it was really fun. Alexis Hamilton was the teacher there, and she's also a wonderful singer, and really helped me to something I already felt but never kind of put into words, that the essence of opera is really poetic. Like when the aria happens, when everything disappears into the music, it really is about the poetry, and that kind of cemented what I was drawn to, you know, taking that class. And it also, you know, made me see, well, okay, I know they, you know, have really big budgets for their productions, but they're a really open community, and it's like this is possible. It's at least I felt like it's possible in Portland because mm-hmm. there's so many good singers here, so many good people. So that's how it kind of kicked off, and then it was a 5-year process. It took me a couple years of just working to have the confidence to start, and then I needed a good story. So I searched around, and I happened across this wonderful memoir by Viva Las Vegas called Magic Gardens. And when I realized that she loved opera and that she was an opera singer, it was just, it all clicked.
Everything
I'm like,
was so
I'm on a mission from God through Portland's favorite stripper, who does who actually does minister, I think, to our community. So.
Absolutely, without question.
Yeah.
Just in a conversation with her, she definitely does.
Yeah.
Amazing human. Are you writing more opera? Is that in the cards? Is Viva's Holiday going to come back? What's going on with your opera worldview at this point?
All of the above.
All of the above.
Yes. So we are going to bring back Viva's Holiday in 2016. And I'm looking for sponsors. If any of you owns a beer company or, you know, a strip club or, you know, just about anything, really. Law firm. I mean, we talk about attorneys a little bit in the opera.
We do.
I'm looking for sponsors. I'm hoping that we can, find a way to do a longer run than we did last year. That was a part of the feedback that we got from the cast and crew, that a longer run, everyone loved it and everyone wants to bring it back. And maybe, you know, it'll work as kind of this, you know, holiday Portland, very Portland thing to do every year. So
very, very Portland. If anybody is interested in more information about Viva's Holiday, sponsorship, anything like that, how would they go about contacting you?
You can find a contact info from the Cult of Orpheus website. So that's my production company and publishing company for the opera. And it's cultoforpheus.org. And you can also look for Christopher Corbell on, you know, like Facebook or Google or whatever, and just get a hold of me.
All the social media.
Pretty easy to find. So
fabulous. Yeah. Well, let's get back to the sonnets. Why don't you tell us about your next one?
Okay, this one. So I am getting over a little bit of a cold, so we'll see how this one works. Because it's the one that felt weirdest when I practiced it today. But this is the first one that I finished, and it's called Eurydice, and I'm on the Orpheus theme. But it's kind of an interesting, I think, just a different take on the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice than people would first think of about Orpheus going to rescue Eurydice from the underworld. It's a little bit removed from that in that it's assuming that Orpheus and Eurydice are just kind of like Jungian archetypes, and it's all happening inside you. You know, and it's not about, you know, this Hollywood rescue story. It's really about your Eurydice is the beautiful part of you that you want to reach. And that's trapped in the subconscious. It's been bitten by the snake, which is the world, which is karma, which is, you know, the illusion, the matrix, whatever you want to call it. And so that the project is kind of a perpetual one for the part of you that's the poet that is conscious, that wants to author something better, to try and find the part of you that is actually already there. That's the more beautiful part of you that is in the underworld.
Uh-huh.
So that's the inspiration. And and I guess it's kind of sort of a personal take on that Eurydice. Come to me, I say, when I am alone with every chance of love I might have missed. Come to me, I say, when I am alone and you, the one I call, do not exist. And you, the one I call, rise up, imagined, like some Greek muse, ambrosia on your lips, eyelids painted black in Stygian pageant, Orphic snake encircling your hips. Sing to me, I ask, as if a song were something that a shadow could achieve. Sing to me, I plead, when all along it's I who sing to you, to make believe that I might be imaginary too, that I might be as beautiful as you. Come to me, I say, when I'm alone. With every chance of love I might have missed. Come to me, I say, when I'm alone. And you, the one I call, do not exist.
like some Greek muse, ambrosia on your lips. Eyelids painted black in Stygian pageant, Orphic snake encircling your head. A shadow could achieve. Sing to me, I plead, when all along it's I who sing to you to make believe that I might be.
Well, I don't think you had anything to worry about. That sounded fantastic.
Thanks, Camille. It helped when I hiked the headphone off my ear.
Usually
pro
does.
Trick.
So what can you tell us about your process and how you arrive at these fabulous sonnets? Do you hear something musically and does the writing come from there? Is it reverse? Tell us a little bit.
Yeah. In my more kind of free-form songwriting, I've definitely worked in every direction. Sometimes I'd start with just music or just words or with snippets of each and kind of build it. But with the sonnets, it's been a more deliberate process, I think, because I started doing the art song settings where I started working with, you know, some poetry by a poet that was already written. So I always started with the words. And that's generally what I'm doing now is I'm actually just carrying this notebook wherever I go. And writing sonnets, you know, sometimes it's just like writing a couple of lines of iambic pentameter and then figuring out what rhymes with it and stuff.
Right.
And so it takes some time. But once I have a sonnet fairly complete, then I'll go through and usually set the melody. And that's how I approach the opera, too, is that I would usually do the melody first before I do any of the accompaniment. And I might have some idea for what's going to go on harmonically and with the accompaniment, but it's the melody is kind of the primary thing. And then I'll fill it out and one interesting thing that I find happening is that so I'll have a sonnet that I think is done. It seems like, yeah, that's a good sonnet when I read it. And once I start setting it to music, it's like, well, no, that it doesn't work because there's some words that just don't I can't find how to make them musical, how to sing them musically. Mm-hmm. And the cool thing about that for me, the cool discovery that I made is that when I let the music revise, a music-driven kind of revision, usually it does make the sonnet better. It's not just a musical adaptation. It usually actually improves kind of the coherence and everything else. So it's got me kind of spooked. It's like there's this weird, kind of round-trip muse thing going on. And it makes me think, if I'm ever going to write just poetry, I should set it to music anyway, just to make sure it doesn't suck, you know, because that exercise is really working so far. So, yeah.
Well, would you like to bring us another one? We're gonna.
Yeah, we're
doing.
Time's flying.
Yeah, doing a great job on our time here.
Cool. Well, it's almost Mardi Gras time, and I don't know if anyone saw the awesome photos from New Orleans in the wake of David Bowie's passing away, but they had a second line in New Orleans with Arcade Fire and the Preservation Hall Brass Band leading a second line, and the whole frickin' town turned out in glitter, and it was just really, I mean, it's just one of those beautiful things that makes, I lived in New Orleans before, that's where I kind of, first found my voice as a songwriter and played on the streets and played in bands down there, and it was just really kind of nostalgic and wonderful to see. And I even saw some of my friends in the crowd, like walking down the road. But so this piece is called Carnival, and I wrote it here in Portland. I wrote the sonnet about a year ago around Mardi Gras time. But so it was mostly about Portland and stuff that I'm feeling now. But there was definitely this, feeling back to Portland and back to New Orleans and kind of the way Mardi Gras feels there. So, Carnival. The crows are on the wing. The people stream into the streets awash with sweat and beer. The deep nocturnal river shows the gleam of carnival. Ash Wednesday is almost here. The king and queen are drunk. The jester jests. The serpent booms. The drums thrash every ear. The masqueraders bare their moonlit breasts and ghost-like dance. Ash Wednesday's almost here. All our frenzied lessons have been learned. All our heat has melted frigid poles. All our shining ecstasies have burned and turned our hearts to diamond-ready coals. The year ascends. The crocus shows no fear. So bloom, sweet sins. Ash Wednesday is almost here. The crows are on the wing. The people stream into the streets, awash with sweat and beer. The deep nocturnal river shows the gleam of carnival. Ash Wednesday's almost here. The king and queen are drunk. The jester jests. The serpent booms. The drums thrash every ear. The masqueraders bear their moonlit breasts and go dance. Ash Wednesday's almost here. All our frenzied lessons have been learned. All our heat has melted frigid poles. Burn and turned our hearts to diamond ready coals. The year ascends, the crocus shows no fear, so bloom sweet sins. Ash Wednesday's almost here.
Oh, I really love that. I really, really love that. I need you to get these recorded for me so that I can go home and listen to them. They're great.
Cool, thanks. If there's any indie label moguls that are listening that want to do a record with me, I'm totally...
You hear this?
I'm looking.
You hear this, Portland? I know you're out there somewhere.
I'm on the prowl. I want that 180-gram black vinyl, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. I noticed in that particular piece that you were playing with the repetition of the line, Ash Wednesday's almost here, and having heard your other pieces, that doesn't seem to be something you do very often. What made you decide to do that in that particular piece?
Yeah, I think it was that line captured so much of what I wanted to say, and it just like flowed out that way. And I mean, it's not the canonical sonnet form to do that. You know, you would alter it. Although I think it is a sonnet in a lot of ways. It does have that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has that bridge built in. Right. But that one definitely has the most normal song structure because of the repetition. It feels like a verse and a chorus, and then it has the little bridge, and then it comes back with the chorus again. So it's, you know, it's fun. Like, I'm not, obviously I'm not on a rule book or anything.
Right.
It's exploration, but.
I think that's what I appreciate most about the Sonnet Project is that you play, even within the form that you're using, you play, you know, with adding the refrain line, with it doing those things. I think it's what makes it most unique. Do you find yourself deliberately aiming toward those different devices, or is it just kind of however it comes out?
Yeah, I think each sonnet's kind of its own world. Like, I'm not really trying to create sort of a cycle of related pieces. Each one is its own kind of standalone thing. I feel like the form and the approach is enough, and it's, you know, I'm just doing it all with my guitar and my voice, so I think there's going to be a unity to it regardless. But I like, there's this favorite line of Whitman's where he says, "I contain multitudes." You know, he's talking about how, like, don't bash him for contradicting himself or whatever. Right. And I think we all contain multitudes, and that as artists, we should, you know, we should celebrate that. In fact, that kind of reminds me that I saw on Facebook a friend or colleague who posted something about David Bowie, and it kind of rubbed me the wrong way, because he was saying, well, you know, from this sort of intellectual standpoint, well, he changed this stuff so much. Like, why did he do that? Why couldn't he be consistent or something? And I'm like, are you serious? Like, are we robots? What are we here for?
Justin Bieber's consistent.
Thank you.
Thank you, voice of God. Patrick Bocard over there in the booth for us this evening, as usual. Hi, Patrick.
Although the voice of God will butt out now.
You know, I also wanted to mention something about the refrain, too, is obviously these things rhyme. And one of the things I like about rhyme is I love this sort of feeling that the roots of poetry are incantation. It's like a spell. It's like a religious ritual or something, a spiritual ritual.
Absolutely.
And I think once I hit that line, it felt like such an incantation. It felt like a spell.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to cast a spell. I didn't want to, like, change it just for intellectual curiosity purposes.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah. I feel like it really comes off that way, too. It does. It feels like you're going back through, you know, kind of like the whole religious calendar that states, you know, here's when Ash Wednesday is. I feel like it really plays into that same idea.
In Louisiana, we used to get out of school for Mardi Gras.
Very nice.
Yeah, it was like a school holiday.
That's awesome. Let's go for another sonnet, shall
okay,
we?
Okay, yeah. Let's see. Do we have time for one more or two
we
more?
We should have time for two more.
Okay, cool. This one is another piece. You know, the first one I wrote was inspired by Jessica Beer's photography, and this one is inspired by my friend Jen Fuller's sculpture. And I feel like this is something I really enjoy in this community, is being inspired by inspiring people here, and kind of this recycling of artistic energy. I think that's the way it's supposed to work. Like, we're not supposed to be looking at what's on TV or wondering what Hollywood wants or whatever. We're supposed to be like linking what each other is doing and building on it and bouncing ideas off. So Jen made this wonderful sculpture that she told me about before she even made it, when we were just hanging out in a dive bar drinking and talking poetry and stuff. And it's inspired by a line in a Mary Oliver poem about crows, about their I'm going to botch the line, but it was like their strong thick wings or something like that. Mm-hmm. Strong black wings. I don't recall, but it's the title of her piece, so I'm sucking at remembering that. But it was a beautiful piece. It premiered over at Blackfish Gallery, and what it was she collaborates with a metal sculptor, and she's a glass sculptor, and it was these crow's wings that came out of the wall and kind of at all these wonderful angles with the shadows coming down. And as they ascended, they were metal. They were like dark metal. But as they ascended, there were glass feathers. And so they got more transparent as they ascended.
Ooh.
And it was just a really beautiful piece. So this sonnet was inspired by her work, but also by her as an artist, you know, seeing her whole process, hearing about the piece early, and then seeing it realized and just kind of celebrating that. This is called Jen's Wings. Your wall ascending wings of glass and steel were steps my old crow heart hopped up to view the arc of all your hours and to feel your steady will's ascent towards someplace new, to note the shadows that shook from your eye, to want to touch your textured artifacts, and to abstain in reverence of their wry and bold fragility, the poet's facts you fixed to time's expanse. These brought me peace through welcome restlessness. What are we here in nature's rich decay, in this brief lease of body, if not flight, as dark as deer, our wings in buoyant crucifixion spread, and carry us in love, in light, in dread.
So we're getting closer to the end of the show. Do you have any shows coming up that our listeners can find you at?
Yeah, I'm kind of out and about a lot these days, playing small gigs and open mics and all kinds of stuff. But a couple of things I got on the calendar for sure are February 9th at the Portland Round and in St. John's. And, you know, you probably remember better than me the address and stuff, or where to find out info about it.
So the Portland Round happens over at Portland Abbey Arts. It's in a wonderful art space in the basement of an Episcopalian church, actually. I just played their show last week, and I was a poet for their show a while ago. And actually, one of the poets that I'm featuring in my broadcast next month was our poet at this last one.
That's great.
It's a very small artistic community. It makes me very happy.
That's awesome.
But yeah, show starts at 8, and it's a $5 cover because they actually pay their artists, which is really exciting.
Woohoo! Yeah, so I'll be there February 9th. And then a month from tonight, February 18th, I'll be at Floyd's Coffee for their series, their music series that's really great. And it's really informal, and it's, I think, donation. So, you know, come on out. And Sean Frenette, a wonderful guitarist who I met through the classical revolution scene, who just does really fantastic instrumental work, and also has I think he has other stuff planned too, but we're going to do the show together at the Floyd's Coffee on the 18th of February.
So. Fantastic. On that note, I'm going to go ahead and tell you all about the other shows that are coming up. Tomorrow night, Tuesday, January 19th, downtown at the Corner Bar attached to the Rialto is Salon Skid Row. Fantastic weekly show that features an open mic and featured performers. Josh Lubin hosts that. And tomorrow night's show is actually the Fetish Show. So if you can make your way down there, I highly, highly suggest. It's a free show. Doors at 7, show at 8. Well worth checking out. On Wednesday, my friend Jenny Forrester hosts Unchaste Readers, Women Reading Their Minds. And she always has fantastic lineups of lots of brilliant, brilliant women. That show is happening at 7 p.m. at Literary Arts at 925 Southwest Washington. Please go down and support that series. I've had the privilege of reading with them a number of times, and it's pretty cool. Also, coming up the beginning of next month, Curtis White Carroll and his lovely wife Amanda are hosting New Poet Challenge number 12 over at Pairings Wine Bar. That is February 2nd from 6 to 8. And the next day, they will also be hosting Word Warriors, which happens at Common Grounds on Hawthorne. That show will be featuring Lisa Galloway, Leanne Grable, Megan St. Marie, and some of the poets that have transferred from their New Poet Challenge. I also understand that Patrick will be having some of the New Poet Challenge poets on Talking Earth next month?
On February 8th. Some of the, not necessarily from that New Poet Challenge, but some of the poets who have read at it over the past year or 6 months. I believe Amy J. Tran was one of the names I saw. That's second Monday of next month.
Beautiful. All right, Christopher, really quick before we go into your last sonnet. You've been a part of the Portland music and arts scene for a long time, and you and I before the show were getting to talk a little bit about what you feel makes our particular arts community unique. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'd love to. I definitely don't think I could have produced an opera on my own anywhere but here. You can do something anywhere if you have the gumption and you're willing to scale it down enough. But but to have a 12-piece orchestra and to have a packed house for 3 nights, it was the most beautiful, like, 3 days. I was just like all endorphins for those 3 days. And I really do believe, like, there's just an openness here. I mean, I approached people to participate in this. You know, the crew that we had, the directors, the talent we had singing on stage, these were just fantastic artists. But there was nothing of that kind of hierarchy that you might get in a more competitive landscape or in a city where people are more saying, well, what can you do for me? Is this going to help me make it?
Right.
And I think what's at the root of that is a sense that culture for us, I think, who believe, isn't something that's out there. It's not the entertainment industry. It's not the academic. It's not Western cultural history. It's not nationality, for crying out loud. But you know, some critics still think it is. I read an opera review about a new opera, you know, like a couple weeks ago, and the critic was asking, well, I'm not sure if this is what it means to be an American opera in the 21st century. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I think what matters in Portland is what should matter in the future for, like, globally. It's like what's going on in your community, in your city, because that's really where culture matters. I mean, this is where we nourish each other. It's kind of like, I mean, I guess it's kind of like a farm to table movement for art or something, but it's just so natural, like that. And it really is, and we don't believe that. So,
no.
Yeah.
All right, Christopher, we have just about 3 minutes left. Do you think you can power through that last sonnet piece for us?
I think so. This is a quick one.
All right.
This is called Pilgrimage. Your circuitry of star and spark and blood runs a course untraced on any map. Satellites can't pinpoint where you stood if you stood for something. Roads unwrap the obvious scars of movement on the land. Hearts hide what the journey really meant. Empty trips are those which go as planned. Empty pilgrims count the coin they spent and hold that as the sum of travel's cost and call their reason to be on the road some monument whose relevance is lost the more it's known. Familiar signs corrode. Strangers, let's be off toward zones more strange and see how much this April trip can change.
All right, one last time. This is Christopher Corbell. I'm Camille Perry, and this has been Talking Earth. Take it away, Christopher.
Your circuitry of star and spark and blood runs a course untraced on any map. Satellites can't pinpoint where you stood if you stood for something. Roads unwrap the obvious scars of movement on the land. Hearts hide what the journey really meant. Empty trips are those which go as planned. Empty pilgrims count the coin they spent and hold that as the sum of travel's cost, and call their reason to be on the road some monument whose relevance is lost the more it's known. Familiar signs corrode.
Thank you so much, Christopher.
Thank you, Camille.
This is KBOO Portland, community radio for the Pacific Northwest. Stay tuned at midnight for Joe Woods and the Tiki Cha-Cha Club. Right now, it's the bedtime radio show for grown-ups, Gremlin Time.
Good evening. This is Fortunato. Tonight, we're going to present a landmark piece of science fiction writing that first appeared in the July 1934 issue of Wonder Stories. Even today, it is considered one of the best science fiction stories ever written. So listen now as Red Ryder presents